All right. So, long time no see. Good evening. Good evening, everyone. Good to see you. We're a little bit more shrink today. I think it's because of the hour. Anyway, good to see you all, those of you who came. Welcome to the sixth and last class of Introduction to Jewish Philosophy. I don't think it's an introduction anymore. I think we've been through through many so far, and we've been through quite a lot. That's why I don't think it's an introduction anymore. I think we had some very interesting discussions in this series. I think we covered some very nice, a wide range of topics and subjects. Because we didn't have a class last week, I will try a little bit to remind exercise our brains and remind us what we talked about in the entire series. It's been a long series, and what we discussed last week. I see more people join the Zoom. I will just ask you again if you can all mute yourself, and if you have any questions, please write them down or wait towards the end of the class. So we started talking in this series. We opened with asking, can we question our faith? Can we even ask philosophical questions about the Kadosh Baruch Hu, about Torah, about Halacha? Or maybe we should only have what Rabbi Nachman, which we will meet today as well, said it called as Emunat Tamima. Emunat Tamima, I mean, don't ask, don't challenge yourself. Just be a simple Jew. Don't be too sophisticated. Don't ask too much. This was our first step in a journey where we covered many, many different movements within the range, the spectrum of Jewish philosophy. We started with the rationalist and the Rambam, the Maimonides. We moved to talk about the Kabbalah, the Zohar. We had a bonus class talking about the Hasidut, the Hasidim. What exactly is the Hasidim? The different parts, the aspect, what led to the Hasidic movement to grow, to rise in Europe. We talked about 2 weeks ago about the Jewish thought before the Holocaust. We gave Rav Kook as an example. If you remember, we read some different parts of Rav Kook, Rabbi Avraham Cohen Kook, and a thought. Again, I'm asking people please to mute yourself. Possible. We read some of Rav Kook's thought about harmony and the harmonism world, and about the fact that everything in this world will actually be one. It all comes from one source, the good, the bad. Everything that you see, even if we don't understand, has good meanings into it. And then we said that something happened. And what happened is a big thing. It's not only the Holocaust, but in general, this generation that experienced World War II has changed something in not only in Jewish thought, but in general. It changed something in the way that people think, in philosophy in general. Because sentences or things or ideas like Rav Kook's that said, everything comes from one place, everything comes from one source, also the bad and the good, they're both harmonized, is really a very difficult statement to say and to declare in a world where people experienced the Nazis. It's a very, very difficult statement to explain. And many, many people really believe that if Rav Kook would experience the Holocaust, we've talked about it last session, that if Rav Kook would experience the Holocaust, the Shoah, he would not write down many of the things he wrote down today. And this leads us to talk today about postmodernism and the Jewish response to it. We opened a little bit the discussion about postmodernism last time, and I want to rediscuss it and to explain again what postmodernism is. I asked some questions last time. If you remember, we will re-ask them today. I didn't explain why I asked those questions last time, so we will do it again. And I remember what those who answered what they said, both on Zoom and in person. We'll see if you change your mind since 2 weeks ago. So in general, I'm going to do it briefly because we talked about it 2 weeks ago. In general, the philosophical world would be divided. The more, let's say, the new philosophical world, which is not the ancient Greek philosophers, we can divide the world of philosophy into three main streams. The first one you can see in those sources that you have. The first one called pre-modern philosophy. The pre-modern philosophy, I brought René Descartes as an example. Pre-modern philosophy said in general, and really, really briefly, that there is one truth, and this truth can be reached. For example, everything or anything that is not logic, anything that I cannot explain or prove with my intellect, is not real. It's not true. For example, God. God is not something I can actually prove with scientific tools. And therefore, God is not true. For example, why? Because there is one objective truth in the world, and there is a way to achieve it. And only if you would train and work on yourself more and more in your intellect, the more you learn, the better you're going to be, and the better you will know the true things in the world. Then we move to what is called the modernism. Now, I know most of us define ourselves as modern people. So the modernism is still a movement that we're still part of, but in a philosophical, cultural, I would say, aspect, we're already what is called postmodern people. And we'll explain in a minute why. But what did modernism said? And I brought Karl Marx as an example here. Modernism said, first of all, the same thing as the pre-modernism philosophers said. There is one truth, and this truth can be reached. Maybe the tools are different. Maybe the way to reach this kind of truth, of aim at truth in a capital T, it's supposed to be, yeah, can be reached. But the modernism added another thing. And they added that truth, there is one objective truth in the world, but it cannot be reached. For example, many of the religious, and we talked about the religious philosophers, also Rav Kook, would say, of course God is the objective truth of the world. Of course God exists. There is no doubt that God exists. But unfortunately, I cannot prove you that. But I know, for 100%, no doubt at all, that God exists. I can't know it now, but in the days of the Messiah, the Mashiach, Be'ezrat Hashem, we will all know that. I'm sorry, but now we're limited. There's no way for me to prove it. But this is the objective truth. If you don't believe in that, you're probably wrong. This is a modern kind of claim. This is a modern kind of theory. And after World War II in general, not only World War II, some of it started developing before, but World War II gave it a very, very strong push, is the postmodernism. And I brought Jean-François Loretat here as an example. There's many more French philosophers who they affiliate with the postmodernism kind of theory. And they said two stuff. First of all, we saw what happened in Germany. We saw what happened in Italy. We saw what happened in China. We saw what happened in the Soviet Union. We saw what happened when people, groups, nations claim that they own the truth and they pursue this ownership forward. We see what then when someone says, I know what's the best in the world, I know what the truth is, he ends up burning people alive. He ends up putting people in gas chambers. He ends up decreeing people in his own country and ruling them like a dictator. So the society, not as an active change, we talked about it, that changes can be active or passive, not as an active change. It's not that one day someone woke up and said, let's change the way we think in the world. No, it was a passive, slowly change that still exists. We're still in the midst of it. But people started to release themselves from the need to find and to prove the fact that there is one objective truth in the world. Sentences like, I have my truth, you have your truth, we can disagree, this is fine, we will not agree anymore. Those kind of sentences are not modern. And they're not pre-modern. Those kind of sentences that I have my truth, you have your truth, those are post-modern kind of sentences. Those are post-modern kind of theories. If someone says, I'm sorry, but you should not, don't offend them. You have your way. Your political views or the way you think into the world is, the result of the places you grew up to, in the school you went to. You're just a summary of all the different people you met during your lifetime. This is a postmodern kind of theory. And postmodernism in general said two things. Or first of all, that all is true. Everything is true. You're right. Oh, we don't know who's true because there's no objective truth in the world. Everything can be true. Everything can be one truth in the world. Or the other phase of this coin of postmodernism said there is no truth at all. At least I ask people if they can meet themselves on the Zoom. The other part of the postmodernism said there is no truth at all. Now, it's kind of the same thing. If I say that everything is true, then nothing is true. If truth is not an objective concept anymore, it's a subjective concept, I can have my truth, you can have your truth, I can change my truth from time to time, I can buy a new identity, I can buy new values, then it's not real. It's not an objective truth. Saying that all is true or that nothing is true is basically the same thing. And I summarize it up. If modernism said in general that there is harmony in the world, and even if we don't see it, the world is harmonized behind it, everything is at the end derived from one objective truth, can be God, can be science, can be intellect, can be whatever you want to name it, then World War II, we call it, but in general, the past 100 years has changed it into what we call controversy, disharmony, and many truths in general. And I asked here a question last week, which was a very interesting question, because most of you didn't disagreed with each other. And this was that if you end up being in, in Africa, and you see a tribe, a native tribe in Africa that was never exposed to human civilization before, and you see them actually sacrificing one of their women to their god, and you see this woman wants to be killed, she wants to be sacrificed, she wants to be thrown to the fire because she thinks this is what's good to her soul, this is what's good to her nation, this is what's good for her land. Hypothetically, if you could stop it, would you stop it? On the one hand, some said, of course I would stop it. This is wrong. This is 100% wrong. They were killing her. She thinks it's good for her, but she doesn't really know it's wrong for her. Because if she would only be exposed to a civilization, to a Western developed civilization, she would for 100% think everything is wrong. So of course, I am right. They are wrong. Their culture is wrong. Their practices are wrong. Of course, I will stop it if I can. But on the other hand, we heard voices from some of the participants in this class that said, I would not try to stop it. Who am I to stop it? I mean, that's what they think is good. Why my, and I called it this white privilege kind of values, why my values are actually better than theirs? What's the difference? I mean, we have things in our faith and in our culture that people think are bad, and we gave example of Brit Milah. All right, we give an example that many countries in Europe are thinking of banning Brit Milah, that it would be illegal to practice Brit Milah. I ask people please to mute themselves again. So we saw both sides, and this is what is called postmodernism, because if I would ask my grandmother, and I gave my grandmother as an example, but it's not necessarily my grandmother, maybe also my parents. If I would ask them, would you stop with them? Most of the time, let's give my grandmother, because my parents are already, I think, kind of changed because of postmodernism kind of world. But if I would ask my grandmother, would you stop it? For sure I would stop it. This is 100% bad. There is no room to say this is right in any case whatsoever. But if you ask a teenager today, would you stop this? You would hear him saying, but who am I to stop it? Why am I this white privileged Canadian in the 21st century? Why would I stop something that they think is right? Like we think the same strength that my rights, my values are right, in the same strength that they think their values are right. So what makes me superior on them, above them? This is postmodernism. And this kind of concept is not only in terms of moral questions like we just saw. It's everywhere. We talked about it. They did also, for example, in arts. In arts. And I gave the story, the classic story that I went on Sukkot to the National Gallery of Canada in Ottawa. And I went, and it was beautiful art in the first floor. Then I went up to the second floor and I saw this huge, ugly kind of art hang on the wall that really my niece, 3 years old, could come back from kindergarten with. And that was worth like $50 million on the wall. It was, I don't want to use harsh words. It was garbage. And eventually, this was part of contemporary postmodern arts, because if there is no one objective truth and there is no one objective way of saying something is beautiful, something is ugly, then everything can be beautiful now, everything can be ugly now, everything can be hanged and worth $50 million on a wall. So it's not only in moral questions or in ethics, it's not only in culture, it's also in our media, it's in our social media, it's very much in our, I would say, also press and communications and journals and newspapers and everything. You just open your eyes, open your ears, listen, see, you will find it everywhere surrounding you. And this was a huge threat, it's still a huge threat to Judaism. Why is it a huge threat to Judaism? Because we're trying as much as we can to educate our young generation to commitment, obligation, Torah, mitzvot, emunah, irat shamayim. How can you educate, first of all, to them, but also for ourselves? How can we build up an identity that is strong enough, solid enough, shaped enough to say, I'm commitment 100% to those kind of values? How can we advocate our Torah when I know I believe 100% that God exists, but I know that my Christian friend for 100% believes that, Jesus is God in the same strength that I believe that he's not God. So what makes me right and makes him wrong if eventually we're actually fighting in the same volume? Yeah, Steve.
Can't you see, though, that they're, if you look at the common word in all three phases, that they're all searching for a truth? And if society gives permission at different eras, if you will, that you're permitted now to search for that truth. And essentially, it's a matter of self-actualization in terms of acquiring the truth.
So Stephen is here saying that we're all kind of groups here are searching. The pre-modern, the modernism, and the postmodernism are all striving or searching for truth. I agree with you. But there is a difference. On the one hand, there is the pre-modern and modernism. On the other hand, there is postmodernism. While the pre-modern and modernism, they search for, let's call it, truth, capital T truth. The postmodernism would say there's no such a thing. We're not looking for it also. We're looking for subjective truth. And a subjective truth, a local truth, not a universal objective truth, is something that I can develop myself. And now, in a postmodern world, every 12-year-old girl, and again, I'm not coming in judgment, and I'm not coming in any negative ways at all, just to put the word we live in front of our eyes. Every 12-year-old girl, if she wants, almost, but not everyone, we're going there, if she wants to say she's a boy, you will call her a boy from now on. Why? Because she has the right on herself. And if she thinks she's a boy, who are you to say she is not? There's no even objective gender anymore. There's no objective sex. There's nothing is objective in this world anymore. And it becomes more and more and more extreme, and more and more and more, I would say, yeah, more and more extreme, as even in the lower grades, even in young adults and teenagers and children already. All right? I wanna. First of all, I brought, because we don't have enough time, I brought here a link. You can all look at that later, to an article that explains the threats and the danger that postmodernism ideals can have on Judaism. It's called Postmodernist Ideals Always Led to the Demise of Jewish People. Here's Why, by Alex Frank from the Times of Israel. You're all welcome to look for that later on. I will send again the sources in the email, so you can. It's gonna be clickable. We're not gonna get into it now because I think you can all think on the regular threats that this kind of philosophy can have towards Judaism, towards Torah, towards educating, towards saying that God, or HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Echad Shmo Echad, but he's not an objective God anymore, and he's not an objective truth. I think we can all, in some way, I think, identify with the threats of it. However, I do want, in this class, because we're talking post-Shoah philosophy, I want to bring one of the newest postmodern Jewish, bigger Jewish philosopher and thinkers in our generation, who unfortunately he passed away in 2007 from cancer. But actually his influence and his impact are now starting to become bigger and bigger. In Israel, he's already a big name, a very controversial, I think, rabbi. And a thinker. Now that the first book of his was translated into English, I will pass it over so you can all see it. This is the book, Faith Shattered and Restored, Judaism in the Postmodern Age, by Rabbi Shagar, Rabbi Shimon Gershon Rosenberg. Now that he was translated into English, he's becoming more and more also popular in yeshivot in America, in North America. And that's a name that you probably will hear in the coming years. And specifically, the younger generation will hear in the coming years. And again, in Israel, he's already a big name. I want to introduce him and his philosophy today in this class. Because Rav Shagar was the first to actually face postmodernism, but not in the classic critical way. Because until before Rav Shagar, most of the rabbis or the intellectuals, or the, again, he was an Orthodox rabbi, he was a Rosh Yeshiva, he was, you can see a very short biography on the second page of our sources with a picture of him. I'll read it briefly. 1949 to 2007, he was a Torah scholar, Rosh Yeshiva, and a religious postmodern thinker. His thought was characterized by Neo-Hasidism and postmodernism. Doesn't matter now what Neo-Hasidism is, but postmodernism, we now know what it means. And he was the first scholar to actually approach postmodernism not in the regular criticism way. He actually looked at postmodernism and I said, wait, is there actually some aspects within this postmodernism that I can embrace? Is there some things in this very difficult and challenging philosophy that I can take to myself, that I can enrich my Jewish life? In many ways, what he has done to this generation, to the postmodern generation, is very similar to what Rav Kook has done to the modernism back then. Because Rav Kook, when he was in Israel, and he saw the kibbutznikim, for example, and he saw those secular ideology of the kibbutznikim in Israel, he said, I'm not going to fight them. No, I'm going to go on a journey with other rabbis, and I will go from every niche kibbutz for months. I will go for every niche kibbutz, and I will visit those kibbutzim, and I will sit, and I will drink with them, and I will sing with them, and I will talk to them, and I want to see if there is anything in their philosophy that is very different than my orthodox philosophy. He was a Haredi philosopher. But he said, maybe there is something in this foreign philosophy, this Zionism, secularism, Zionism philosophy that I can actually embrace and enrich my own. And by that, he developed what is called religious Zionism. By taking the Zionism, which was not very religious back then, bringing the religious aspect, the religious values, turning it into something that is one of the biggest movements in Israel now. And again, I'm one who affiliate with this kind of movement. So Rav Shagar, in many ways, what he has done is almost the same. He saw postmodernism, not only in Israel, it was not only something local, it was something global, it was a universal movement. And he saw and he said, wait, maybe that's not the big devil. Maybe there are some things that we can actually borrow from this kind of philosophy, and if we blend it with Jewish values, we spice it a little bit with Torah, with mitzvot, with halacha, maybe we end up having something that can actually enrich our lives, but most important, the young generation's life. Because they are the ones who's going to stand with those very strong winds, and they need to have answers. The young generation is going to face, going to grow up, they're already growing up in this such an environment, we need to give them, to develop tools so they can use in order to keep their observance, to keep their Jewish identity, to keep their commitment to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to Halacha, and to Torah. And for doing so, he wasn't afraid, he had a lot of courage, he wasn't afraid to actually face this monster of postmodernism as it is, and actually to say that some things are actually difficult, while other rabbis, all the way until today, those who are opposing Rav Shagar, saying that postmodernism is not even a threat. They're denying the fact that this is something that can really threat the young generations. Some say they're closing their eyes. Some say he was a little bit too dramatic. You can all think by yourself. I took from one of his essays in this book, and please you can see the book. I brought one of the essays that I want us to read and learn together. And we'll see how Rav Shagar is actually approaching those very difficult questions that we ask regarding postmodernism, and what does he offer as a solution or as a new way inside Jewish wisdom, inside Jewish thought, for our generation, for the younger generation, and for the generations to come. Can I ask to divide the reading between all of us? It's fine. Harvey, can you please start for us reading? You can all follow. All right, I'm gonna split the reading.
Faith shattered and restored. In recent years, many moral questions have arisen from the legitimization of ethical and moral pluralism and multiculturalism. Does the democratic West have the right to preach its own ethics to peoples who, for reasons of religion or tradition, oppose it? Is it incumbent upon the West to rail against such customs as widow burning and female genital mutilation, or is it railing against these practices a vestige of patronizing Western colonialism?
Thank you. Thank you very much. Before we just read the first passage, the first paragraph. Before we answer, what do you think? All right, we said, for example, female genital mutilation. Now, this is 100% wrong. I don't think anyone agrees this is fine. What's the difference? We have the same practice for baby boys. Why? How? And what? In what name can we, as Jews, that believe in Brit Milah, in what name can we go and say to other cultures that have the same thing for girls? How can we say no? Sorry, stop it. By what name can we do that? All right. This is a very difficult. Only raising the question is a chiddush by an Orthodox rabbi. This is not. This is groundbreaking. We need to understand. This is not something that someone asked. This takes a lot amount of courage to write down and publish as a book or in an article as something that is public. Can you continue, Harvey? In the second paragraph.
Hence the paradox as to the proper response to acts of violence that are moored in certain cultures. On the one hand, our own values require us to uproot such atrocities and prevent them from occurring. On the other, we are aware on a philosophical and anthropological level that every society has its own culture and values, and that, from the point of view of some societies, violent acts such as honor killings protect the community and its values. It is even seen as immoral to refrain from such behaviors. From this vantage, one can argue that not only must we avoid preventing others from engaging in actions that we consider immoral, but that we should enable such actions, perhaps even fund them if necessary. Indeed, the Israeli anthropologist Dan Rabinowitz reports on such a trend.
Before we read Dan Rabinowitz, just to say, something I was told, probably you know that better than me, that the taxes, the Canadian taxes, go to honor killing as well. I mean, if someone wants to finish his life, OHIP covers it. All right? Just to say. Just in some way or another, the government... What? Someone who is very sick and he wants to finish his life without a job in Colombo. So how do you explain?
Mercy killing.
Thank you. Okay, so this is not something the Canadian government is funding, taking that back, but the mercy killing, that's how you call it in English, mercy killing. So the taxes are actually funding this such a thing, where Judaism says, Allah has no one of us has the right on our lives to decide whether we want to stop it or not. Our lives are not ours. Our lives belong to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and He the only one that can decide when, how, and why someone would finish his life. No one can, but we're paying for that. How come? How come this is something that became legit? If I'll ask my grandmother, this is not even a thing that can even think of being legit. But most of the young generation would say, of course, if he wants to, who are you to tell him stop, don't do it? Yeah? David, can you continue on for us, the third paragraph?
In some cities in England that feature sizable populations of African immigrants, especially from places where it's customary to mutilate the genitals of females, babies, and children, city council members face a difficult dilemma. The immigrant citizens who constituted a significant electoral power demand that practices be included in the list of elective surgeries covered by national health insurance.
Think about it. Why not? Maybe that the national health cover should cover such a thing. If this is a culture, this is the practices of them, we would all want that OHIP would pay for the mohel, right? In the Brit Milah, it would be much easier for us. We would like it. Why for us it's fine to demand it, but for them it's not? And continue. These citizens
who lead a Muslim lifestyle demanded that the municipality not only allow them to circumcise their daughters, but finance the procedure.
Now, who thinks it's fine? Who thinks this municipality should finance this procedure? First of all, those in person. Someone thinks they should? No hands. On Zoom. Someone thinks that these municipalities should finance such procedures? No.
It's a matter of separation of religion and state.
It's a matter of separation of religion and state. This specific it is. But if in general, we say the separation of religion and state, and then you can ask yourself, in some way, there are still things that the government would cover for you in order for your health. All right? Why do you count in, even if you separate religion and state? What do you count in? What do you count out? Why is it something that would not be fine, but I don't know, treatment of cancer would be? What's the difference in that sense? There's still, even a country that separates church and state still deals with those kinds of questions. And again, we can give America as an example that still has those kind of things. For example, not for Muslim communities, but there's many things, for example, the Haredi movement in COVID, that they said, for example, we don't believe in COVID. Why can't we live our lives in the way we want to live our lives anymore? And there was a huge, you know that better than me, I would say clash between a coalition, between the law, and between a group that said, we're not going to harm anyone else. We want to live the way of life as we want to live. Also in Israel, it was the same thing, which is not a religious thing. But if there is a group that has their own values, and those values contradict another group values, maybe the bigger, maybe the majority, whatever you name it, you're going to call the kind of nefashot that you call clothing the haters. It is a kind of nefashot. What can they do? Who are you to say this is a more bigger kind of nefashot than the other thing? It happens in many, many ways, not only in religious and church. In religion and church. Can you continue, please? Thus, yeah.
They will save a lot of money, spare their daughters the risk of inheriting carrying out the mutilation without medical supervision and basic hygienic conditions. And most important, have the opportunity to preserve the culture proudly and publicly. there was at least one city in which the procedure was added to the list of treatments covered by public funds.
There's at least one city in which the procedure was added to the list of treatments covered by public funds. In Israel, it was kind of the same thing, not exactly the same, but there was a huge, very big debate several years ago regarding prostitution. Should prostitution be something that is legal in Israel or not? On the one hand, some of the government ministers said, they said, of course not, we're a Jewish country. How can such a thing be something that is legal in this country? On the other hand, some said, but it's going to happen anyway. So maybe we should fund it. We should supervise it. We should make it legal. So at least we can know that someone keeps or, I don't know, in to save the rights of those women who choose to go that path, go through this direction. Those kind of questions, again, they are not... I don't know what happened to Zoom. Those kind of questions are questions that are actually postmodern. Again, 90 years ago, 60 years ago, those kind of questions were 100% no. David Ben-Gurion said, for example, the Beatles are not allowed to perform in Israel. He said, no, I'm banning the Beatles. Why? Because their songs are not educating, they're not educating enough the children that we'll listen to. There was no even a question, maybe educating, maybe the children. No, he said something is right, something was right. No one even thought maybe that was the wrong thing to do. Today they are debating not about culture, not about singers or bands to come. They're debating prostitution, should that be legal or not, in terms of people. This is a new kind of debates. Those are not regular things. I don't know what happened to the new year. Maybe the Wi-Fi has... I don't know. That's why it's better to come in person. All right. Michael, can I ask you? Can I ask you on the theoretical level?
On a theoretical level, such dilemmas pose interesting intellectual puzzles.
Excuse me, we're back. Sorry for that, we're back. Please mute yourself, and we continue. We are on the paragraph, or on a theoretical level, on the end of the first page. Yeah, Michael.
On a theoretical level, such dilemmas pose interesting intellectual puzzles, but how in our postmodern world should we conduct ourselves in practice? Can I, as an ethical person, ignore the point of view of a member of another culture? Can I ignore a perspective capable of justifying the world of values that gives rise to such action, which according to my values is a despicable crime? Furthermore, in accepting the critical outlook that imposes the imposition of white European values on the world that to white Europeans may appear primitive, can we avoid cherishing the other's point of view?
Just saying that the term of white European values is the translator addition to this to the translation. Originally, the book is written in Hebrew. He didn't write down white or European values. When they translated the work into English, to Americanize it a little bit and to make Americans relate to such an idea, he wrote down, he called it white European values. I think if I remember correctly, in the Hebrew one, it says Arachim Ma'araviim, which means Western values, and not white European values. Anyhow, this is the translation that he chose. Again, just saying, those kind of questions written down by an Orthodox Rosh Yeshiva are groundbreaking. They're groundbreaking, and I don't think people in America has yet achieved to really understand, be exposed to such questions raised by an Orthodox rabbi. Yeah.
But I'll give you one example of a postmodern thought process that happened actually in Talmudic times, or not post-Talmudic times, where they did not allow polygamy anymore. So that, you know, they was deemed to be, well, you know what, in our society, well, you know, it's not going to work. We want to be a shining example. No longer are Jewish men able to have more than one wife. That is, you know.
Why are they postmodern?
Because postmodern, because it takes into account that, you know, this is if you look for more recent today, one would never think twice about having more than one wife. But you go back and because of
one wife's more than enough.
But the truth is that, you know, it takes into account a person having to think beyond their generation, beyond their era, to think that this is not the right way to be. Or maybe it's not advised, but it's not the right way.
So I will challenge what you just said, Stephen, respectfully. And I would say that with the fact that he said that this is there is a right way to live the life and there is a wrong way to live the life, it's already not postmodern. Because a real postmodern will tell you if there is someone... Let's say in Israel, there are still groups, the Arabs groups, there are still groups that are marrying more than one woman, and it's legal if you're an Arab in Israel. Why? Because that's their culture. I know that in my culture, my faith, my belief, it's wrong. In their culture, it's fine. Maybe for my group, my people, for myself, I will forbid it. Who am I to force something that I think is wrong on another group that thinks it's right? And I don't think Jews, if Judaism would say, you're not allowed to marry another woman, but everyone else would be fine if you want to. This would be a little hint of a postmodern maybe theory, but it's not. Because Judaism said, this is up, but we're not going to say anything about any other person. It's wrong in general. It's wrong objectively. Don't do it anymore. If you open for yourself, or you close for yourself something, but you still leave it open for another person, when you acknowledge your differences, the differences between you, this is something that makes it more postmodern. All right, so let's see what Rav Shagar, after he raised such very difficult and challenging dilemmas, very difficult questions, what exactly is his answer? What exactly can he offer to a teenager that reads this kind of question? Then he asks, first of all, Baruch Hashem that there is someone who asks a question that I feel. First of all, that's already half of the solution. Just to hear someone, because this is something that I know. I know because I grew up in this environment, and I know that from other people, from students that I work with, that they have those kind of questions, and only to hear that from an halakhic authority that asks the same questions is already a relief for them, and it's already a progress. But what exactly is the practical thing that he can offer us to do so? And Rav Shagar is mentioned here in this biography, they call him Neo-Hasidism. What exactly is Neo-Hasidism? Very briefly, we talked about the Hasidism. Neo-Hasidism, as its name, and new Hasidism, is taking the values, the core values of Hasidut, and turning it, moving it into the 21st century. In what sense? In a sense that, you know what? There are rabbis, Hasidic rabbis. The rabbis, the Hasidim said that we learned, for example, that the rabbi is something that is in the center, sometimes more than other things. That the Zohar, the Kabbalah, are things that sometimes are overcoming halacha or Shulchan Aruch or other stuff. Maybe we can take those kind of things and apply it to our lives. And we are not Hasidim. We're not Litvaki. We're not Hasidim. We're not anything. But we have such a wide range of a table filled with many, many, many different dishes, with many, many different food. I can choose which food I want to pick. I can choose, I can have this Hasidic rabbi, and I have this Litvak rabbi, and I have this one from here, and a modern Orthodox, and a Haredi, but why not? Who am I, as a postmodern, to say, oh, you were born in a Hasidic family, you must continue the Hasidic way. You want to move? Choose only one path you move to. Why? If I want to be a complex person, if I want to take from Hasidut this, and I want to take from modern Orthodoxy this, why not? This kind of thoughts are very much Neo-Hasidism. But they're not Hasidim, but they're taking some of the core values of Hasidut, and they're turning it into something that is more of the 21st century in that sense. And that's why Rav Shagar will talk now about Rabbi Nachman of Breslov. With all people, he will talk about Rabbi Nachman of Breslov. Oh, the question is, what about Halacha? Now, it's easier in philosophy or in Ashkafa. Halachically, it's more difficult. Can you choose that from here, that from here, that from here? Very difficult. I can tell you, in my personal experience, because I was married a Moroccan. So there are things that we said, okay, now we build our home. After consulting with my Rosh Hashiva, with my posse, we got to a conclusion that there are some things what we are shaping now. So there are things that I didn't do when I grew up, but I do now. Several things for Sephardim. Again, I gave it an example, I think, already. For example, using glass dishes for fleishik and for dairy at the same time. This is something that Ashkenazi don't do lechatchila. This is something that Sephardim are doing lechatchila, because chuchit, glass, is not something that is bolea. It's not something that can absorb the thing. According to the Sephardic Shita, the Ramah there says that no, there's something that actually the Ramah, the Rabbi Moshe Isher, the Ashkenazi posek, says no, we will still be machmirim on that. So this, for example, something that we chose to take from the Sephardic side. Kitniyot, for example. So I am not eating kitniyot, but Priel at home can eat whatever she wants to eat, because I am not a person that I will tell her, sorry, darling, erase all your past, erase all your traditions, put everything that you had back to you. You're not married to me. You're not going to do everything that I was grown. No. She grew up in one way, and I respect her tradition. I'm not going to eat kitniot. She can eat kitniot. Our children will eat kitniot. Why? Because my tradition is not superior to her tradition in that sense. So the children can eat kitniot if they want. They can choose when they grow up, and they can choose if they want to eat or not. Of course, they will choose to eat. I'm not telling myself that they're not supposed. They will not eat. So it depends exactly what and how. It's more difficult in halacha than in hashkafa. It's more difficult.
When you said one superior over another, you just knocked yourself out of postmodernism.
We said I'm a postmodernist.
Okay, but the same, like, because we're
I'll tell you more than that, Joel. The fact that I'm standing here with a kippah and I'm davening and I work as a rabbinic assistant and I have my Jewish values and I try to observe halacha as much as I can, as possible as I try, saying that maybe I don't embrace the entire philosophy of postmodernism, because then I will be in trouble. But let's see what Rav Shagari is offering as a solution to those kind of questions, and he brings in to the table Rabbi Nachman. Say, we ask you to read.
Rabbi Nachman and the Unanswerable Questions. In one of his better-known discourses, Rabbi Nachman addresses this contradiction of the very base of human experience. He refers to this contradiction as conundrums without answers, or conundrums from the void.
Yeah, mehachalal hapanui. Chalal panui, we'll talk in a minute what exactly this concept means in the Zohar.
Rabbi Nachman opens with the assertion that due to his mercifulness, the Lord, blessed be He, created the world for He wished to reveal His mercifulness. It is a difficult claim, as the poet Yehuda Amichai.
You know Yehuda Amichai? Someone heard his name. Yehuda Amichai is a very well-known poet in Israel. He's a very big atheist poet in Israel, and he likes to use religious aspects from his songs, we'll see in a minute, and turn it into his own ideology. Look what he says.
As the poet wrote, Yehuda Amichai wrote in his poem, El Malei Rachamim, know that if not for the God full of mercy, there would be mercy in the world, not just in him. Had God created a better world, perhaps there would be no need for mercy toward him and us. Yet I think Rabbi Nachman really claims, not that the Holy One, blessed be He, created the world so He would have someone to whom to show mercy, but rather that the fundamental note of creation, things it reveals, is mercy. It is not mercy evoked by a specific concrete condition, for instance, a person in a difficult situation. Rather, mercy is linked to the basic paradox of creation as a whole, and specifically to human existence. Rabbi Nachman explains this conflict through the Kabbalistic idea of
Tzimtzum. All right, okay. This is a very high-level kind of discussion. I'll try to explain it in my words, in that sense. Putting aside Yehuda Amichai, with all the respect and everything, just try to explain what is the Torah that Rabbi Nachman is talking about. Torah 64, Samech Daled, Nikutei Moharan. It's a Torah that I personally very love it. I feel very connected to it. And in that Torah, Rabbi Nachman of Breslev, again, in his book, Nikutei Moharan, if you remember, when we talked, the first class, he handed out a sheet with a table with all recommended philosophical books throughout, with a timeline. When I wrote the Rabbi Nachman, I gave Likutei Moharan. Likutei Moharan, the collection of Morenu Harav, Verabeinu Harav, Rabbi Nachman, our master, our teacher, Rabbi Nachman. All right? And that book was not actually written by Rabbi Nachman, but was the collection of his Divrei Torah and his Drashot that was edited by afterwards his student, Rabbi Nathan, his student, but not only, but mainly by Rabbi Nathan, his student. It was published later on after he passed away. And there, it's different derashot and different topics. Usually he opens up with some psukim on the parsha, and then he moves on to talk about something totally different that has no connection to the psukim. And in Torah 64, in the 64th chapter of that book, he has a Torah, a very fundamental and basic Torah, which is a very fundamental Torah in the Breslover kind of Shita. And again, this is a religious and it's an Orthodox rabbi who takes something from Breslov, from the core of Breslov, and brings it into the Israeli existence, into the Israeli essence. And what Rabbi Nachman is saying there is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, when He created the world, He created it for one reason. And the reason is to demonstrate His mercy to the world. Now, on the first surface, just as Rav Shagar wrote down, what does it mean? God is creating the world in order for what? In order to put His mercy. Don't create the world in the first place. Like those who say about the Shoah, oh, why are you said where God was in the Shoah? Look, there was a state of Israel afterwards. No, we don't need the Holocaust in order to establish the state of Israel. If HaKadosh Baruch Hu would want to establish the state of Israel, He could have done that without the catastrophes of the Holocaust. All right? There are some people that still say, oh, but we have Medina Israel. No, Medina Israel did not grow up from the Holocaust. It stands by itself. The Holocaust is a shade in its past, but it's not something that caused the state of Israel. If HaKadosh Baruch Hu would want to establish the state of Israel, He didn't need to have the Shoah for that. And Rabbi Nachman uses the Kabbalistic idea called Tzimtzum. Tzimtzum in Hebrew is shrinking. And they used here constriction. Constriction would be the term that they use here. And see if you can continue reading, and then we'll see exactly what Rabbi Nachman uses, this idea of Tzimtzum here.
This constriction, Tzimtzum, which made way for the void,
halal ha-padui will be comprehensible only in the Messianic age, as one must note that it comprises two diametrically opposed aspects.
And I will try to explain this in my own words. Rabbi Nachman explains that in order for HaKadosh Baruch Hu to create the world, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu is infinite, he's Ein Sof, he's not something that can be put in a space or a three-dimensional world. He had, in order to create this materialistic, three-dimensional world, limited world, HaKadosh Baruch Hu had to shrink from his infinitude, to shrink himself in order to make room for the world to be created. Because if God, this infinite God, if he's infinite, in melokol aretz kevodo, he's everywhere all the time, this materialistic world with good, with bad, with death, with life, everything we have cannot exist within the concept of an infinite God that is not, I would say, is not playing by the rules of this world that we live in. This is something in Rabbi Nachman theory. And this movement, this vector of HaKadosh Baruch Hu shrinking himself in order to make room for the world to be created, this is called in Kabbalah Tzimtzum. This means the God shrinked himself, constriction. And from this constriction, from this Tzimtzum, from that shrinking, the gap that was developed, the gap that was built from where God was to where He is now, this space is called HaChalal HaPanui, the vacant, the empty void, the void space, or whatever you want to call it. The empty space, the vacant space, the void. Because God was here, now God took a step backwards, and now what's here? This is void. And from that void, Tohu Vavohu, from that void, God created the world and was able to create the world. But again, He took Himself a little bit backwards. And this is, and we're not going to read it inside, but this specific thing, this action that God took, is His mercifulness. This is the mercy that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has shown, demonstrated the world by shrinking Himself, taking Himself, throwing Himself backwards in order to make room for the world, that the world would be created from a place where God is absent. We need to understand that God is absent from this vacant space. There is no elokut. There is no godliness in this place, according to the Kabbalah and Rabbi Nachman. From that action that God shrinked Himself, this is His mercifulness, and this is the Halal HaPanui. And yet, says Rabbi Nachman, after this entire manifest, yet, even though that there is no godliness there is still godliness. Even though there is no spirituality there is still spirituality there. And he calls it the paradox. And he says this paradox would not be comprehended. He could not understand that only in the Messianic ages. This is how Rabbi Nachman finishes this Torah and this lecture of things. And in other words, there are places in this world, according to the Breslover kind of Shita, where God was absent. He's still yet, but He's not there, but He's there, but He's not. God was absent from these places. God drew Himself backwards from this vacant, empty space. The world could be created. And everything that we deal with in this world, tragedies, Shoah, happiness, feelings, everything that we have, death, everything that we have in this exists in this universe that we experience is coming from this place where there is no, where God is absent in that sense. And Rav Shagar is asking upon this specific passage of Rabbi Nachman, and he ties it into the postmodern theory. Look, please, on the last passage, on the last page. Eric, can I ask you to read? Yes, thank you. How does
this tie into the question of postmodern justice? I contend that the aforementioned contradiction is among the conundrums for which Rabbi Nachman suggests a solution. Is it the ethical dilemma raised above? Do we have the right to intervene and impose our values on, for instance, Druze, who harm a woman for betraying the laws of the sect? As noted, we can always employ, indeed, we cannot avoid the reflexive point of view, which looks at everything in context.
We cannot avoid the reflexive point of view, which looks at everything in context. First of all, we cannot avoid it. Don't deny it. Don't say, I'm not feeling it. I don't understand the problem. No, there is a problem. If you think you can avoid it, you probably, that's a lie. That's not anything someone can avoid in the world we live in anymore. However, we can continue.
To fully embrace this outlook is to concede that my truth possesses no more value than the truth of a member of any other culture, and that I have no right to intervene in his world. It is a point of view embodying the perspective of the divine infinitude, which can contain all opinions.
On the one hand, yeah, Rav Shagari is first of all on saying, you know what? There is a little bit of truth in saying that who am I to stop something like that, even though my Torah says this is wrong. Still, there is something. There is kind of a legitimate point of view that I am part of that I can say, wait, but why? What, how can I stop it? Yet
I am still a specific person with my own specific truth, an individual who believes in his truth and who thus cannot deny it, nor does he wish to do so.
There is godliness in this place, but there is also no godliness in this place. From this vacant space in the world, those are questions that have no answers. Rav Shagar is not giving an answer, a solution, something solid that someone can actually go through. He actually says, you know what, guys? We need to stay in a question mark. But it's not staying in a question mark by saying, I don't have an answer. He's saying, I don't need to have an answer for such a question. I don't need to have an answer. How can I really believe in God when someone believes in a different God in the same strength? I don't need to have an answer. Why? Because I know I'm right. Because this is my local truth. He has a local truth as well. But I know I'm good with who I am. He knows who he's good with who he am. I don't need to prove anything. Not to myself. Not to him. Not to anyone else. And those kind of places where there is something but there is not. This is something that Rav Shagari is borrowing from Rabbi Nachman. Saying this is the halal panui. This is the vacant space. This is where godliness is absent at the same time, and in the same instance, it's also appearing there. Same would be with the opinions, same would be with truth, same would be with values, same would be the things that we don't necessarily can understand and know, don't have an answer for that. And if we can wrap it up, then I wrote down here in two and three points. If we talked last week about the pre-Holocaust ideology, and I gave Rav Kook as an example, and if we talk about post-Holocaust ideology, I chose Rabbi Nachman, even though he lived even earlier than Rav Kook, but now he's being Kamle Tchia here now, and we use him for out of the tree and out of the grave, and we use him now after the Holocaust. And if we try to summarize it, we can say that pre-Holocaust ideology by Rav Kook said the world is Arminius, all controversies serve one total goal. We just need to reveal the harmony that is out there. We all serve this goal, even if we don't mean to, says Rav Kook. While Rabbi Nachman said, the world is not harmonious. There are some paradoxes in the world we live in. There are some things we don't understand. Not everything is harmonized. Not everything is nice. Not everything can we comprehend. Or not everything is solid. There are places in the world where God is absent, yet He's there. Yet He's absent. All controversies are severe and stuff. Two, the controversies are essential to forming a stable society. And three, the controversies are also essential to our faith. Because if someone will try to believe, try without trying in faith in those kind of questions, if it will only stick with actually believing that Emunah Tamima, and this can wrap up, and we'll wrap up now our series, but if someone can believe that only Emunah Tamima, only believing with no asking questions, only believing with closing your eyes, your ears, not trying to be influenced and not hearing different voices that appear in the philosophical world, it will not work for him. We can grow in our Avodat Hashem also from this controversy, also from this doubt. And I think that in that note, if we look about everything we achieved so far in this series, I think we can all in some way or another understand this point, that if we started with asking, should we even ask questions in our faith? Should we even do something? The answer is, capital Y, yes. There's no even question if someone in this world would not ask questions in his faith. First of all, for himself. Because there are very strong winds out there that we need to have tools and armors and shields and whatever we can in order to face them. Sometimes we will be hit and we will be injured. But we will grow up differently from these injuries, as we saw, because the Rambam was someone that was hit very much from the wind surrounding him. From the Greeks, we saw it, from the Greek philosopher, from Aristotle, from Plato, from different philosophers. He was hit from them, and many rabbis said back then, if you remember, no, we need to ban Rambam of what he's doing. We need to burn his books. One second, Steve, all right? We need to burn his books. Yet, Look at Judaism today. Same would be with Kabbalah, with the Zohar, with the Ari. How many people look at them back then? And now we can see that here, Rabbi Nachman and the Kabbalah are growing again in a postmodern world theory, even though some people think maybe they died or maybe the Breslover are only a very a weird, extreme group of Hasidim that have their own kind of Torah. Those kind of, I know that in America it's still not there, but those kind of theories, those kinds of ideas of this kind of language is actually something that becomes more mainstream and mainstream in the modern Orthodox religious Zionism groups in Israel. And we saw the Hasidim, again, we can see the Hasidim were there, but now it's, in general, we can say that in our generations, and I for sure it would be like that in the next generation, that we don't know what the future would invite us, we don't know what's going to be, how the future is going to be like. We do know that for ourselves, we must build a strong Jewish identity based on honesty and not denying such difficult questions, but rather hearing them, believing, being confident in our identity and trying to develop different tools to keep with it. And second of all, not only for ourselves, also for our children, for the younger generation, maybe even it's more important that they need to have role models, they need to have contemporary, relevant Jewish philosophy and thought that they can relate to, and not something that would be too old-fashioned, not something that cannot connect to relate to, and eventually, if they're not feeling it, they will throw it away. And on that note, we have 3 more minutes for questions, but I want to thank you all for joining this series. There's many things to discuss. We'll give it in a minute. All right, don't worry. I'm going to use the question. I just want to thank you all for coming in person. It's been six classes. We added one more, so thank you for that and for not giving that up. Thank you for all those on Zoom that came every week. Some of you came in person and on Zoom, and then in person and on Zoom. Bezrat Hashem, all of us will be in person in the next series. We need to figure out when and why and how. Michael, I'm looking at you because we need to figure that out. And Bezrat Hashem, again, when we all be in person, and we'll have more opportunities of learning and growing together. I'm going to get questions from the people in person. If you have a question on Zoom, please keep on and wait here on the Zoom until I finish here, and then I will move to the Zoom, and I will ask your question. I will listen to the question. Yes, Steve.
How do you think Rabbi Nachman's ideology would look at Jews for Judaism?
I'm not so familiar with Jews to Judaism to tell you. What I know from my speaking with Julius, what I know would be that just advocating Judaism for those who might be drawn by Christianity and something like that, just to advocate Judaism. I don't know what are the values that they're representing. I don't want to say something that I'm not really an expert of and don't know of. All right, any more questions? Well, all clear. A very difficult session. Yeah, you're up.
Just a quick, I'm just wondering if there's a typo in Rabbi Nachman's ideology. The world is not harmonious. All controversies are severe and stopped. What do you mean by stopped?
Which one are you reading?
On the last page, it says Rabbi Nachman's ideology.
In Hebrew, it would say kashua, harsh.
Yes, severe, but what about and stopped?
What do you mean the stuff things? If something is stuff, what do you mean when you say that?
Well, stuff is this thing.
What is stuff with an A? A staff with an A. Oh, that's a crew, right? That's just people the worst. No stuff things. Well, this is stuff. I cannot take it out. That's not a thing you say in English? I don't, man. Never mind. Erase this word from the... But again, we're postmodernism. We can say that I wrote stuff, but I actually mean something else, and you can look at it, and I will sell this passage for $50 million if someone wants to buy it. If you want to hang it up. All right. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you very much, and Laila too.